We're doing a little series of study that I call Slaves of Christ. And we introduced the idea a couple of weeks ago that the Scriptures use this unusual word, slave, to describe our relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, normally we find that word pretty repulsive because of our own history, our own culture, and what that has meant in the past. For us, and we still see it regularly, even in the newspapers today, not so much talking about our own historical past as a nation, but sort of building upon that. You'll hear about the slave trade, the sex slave trade, and how many people are held in virtual slavery, whether it be illegal immigrant workers, or whether it be women, or whether it be children, or whatever it may be. Even there was an article late this past week about upcoming 2022 or maybe 2020 World Cup games that are going to be held in the very small nation of Qatar, one of our allies in the Gulf region. And all of that work for building the stadiums and getting the whole nation ready for this huge sporting event that's still 6 or 8 years away will be done by immigrant workers. They'll be bringing in people from India and Nepal and other Asian countries to do that work. And the article was quite slanted in the direction of saying that they will work as virtual slaves. People know that that word slave introduces a very negative image in the minds of almost everyone. And well, it should. But there are some aspects of that that are not negative. And the Scriptures do use that word numerous times to describe our relationship with Jesus Christ. So we're building some background and some perspective on this as we look at the Scriptures. Last week, we looked at slavery in the Old and New Testament, the actual practice of slavery, how it was regulated by the law of Moses, that there were only certain things that could and could not be done with a slave in the Old Testament. Same is true with the New. The Roman law, while the Roman Empire existed, was very specific about some aspects of slavery. And there's some very big differences between slavery in biblical times and slavery as we tend to think of it from our own historical past. We know in our own past, as a nation, that slavery was almost totally racially produced. That is, it involved around one race of people being enslaved to another or other races of the black or African-American, as we now call them, race of people, were enslaved. That was not true in Jewish and Roman society. Almost anyone could be a slave. It was not dictated by race. It was either dictated by someone had been captured during one of the great wars that took place, both Old and New Testament, or it might have come about as a result of great financial debt that someone had fallen into, or it might have even been dictated because of some crime they had committed, would actually be put into slavery as a punishment for that. But what we want to start out by talking about this morning, first of all, is this whole use of the word slave is a figure of speech. Figures of speech are what make language work, along with vocabulary and grammar. There's probably some other things. I'm no English scholar or even didn't even major in it in school, but I know at least three things that make up language is vocabulary, the words themselves, the grammar, how those words connect together, and figures of speech. And figures of speech have to do with all sorts of ways that those words are used to communicate more adequately the thoughts and ideas of the speaker in such a way that the hearer understands what they mean. And some of the most common figures of speech in at least the English language, and I know this was also true in the Greek language, which the New Testament was originally written in, are what's called similes and metaphors. These are analogies. Analogy means something that is compared or related to something else. And so when we talk about a simile, we use that all the time when we talk about something is like something else or something is as something else. A great example that pops to my mind right out of the scriptures in the Old Testament, in the Psalms, and we have a hymn that's written on the basis of it, "As the deer pants for the water, so my soul longs after you." That's a simile, as the deer. So it's comparing what our soul or heart feels to how, what a deer feels when it is thirsting for water. And again, it's coming out of a context in which they lived in a part of the world that was fairly arid, like our area here is. And animals would often have to travel some distance to find water, as again here. And so it compares that to our own heart. A simile is a comparison between one thing and another that is only emphasizing maybe just one or two points of comparison. And so they're called similes. And many, many illustrations out of our own life as well as out of the scriptures could be given. That's not my point to belabor that this morning. But the other kind of common analogy as a figure of speech is that of a metaphor. A metaphor is much stronger than a simile because it doesn't say something is like something else or as something else, and so only emphasizing one or two points of comparison. It will actually say one thing is something else, is another thing. And this most often has to do, in the scriptures at least, with points of comparison spiritually with things that are physical. That's where the use of the word slave comes in. To talk about us being slaves of Christ is a metaphor. It takes a physical reality that everyone understood in biblical times and that we understand in a slightly different but similar way today and says that's what we are in our relationship to Christ. It's taking a physical reality and connecting it to a spiritual reality. In our human language, our English language is just filled with metaphors. In fact, many things in our dictionary end up being added or changed or added onto because of this whole concept of metaphor. Over time, words, vocabulary we already have get used in new ways. And at first, it's just a metaphor. But eventually, it becomes so much a part of our language that it moves essentially from metaphor into vocabulary. Let me give you an example from the area I know something about, and that's in the area of computers. I work on them all day long. Most of my career, even in ministry, has been connected to the computer industry in one way or another. We hear all sorts of things, and we use all sorts of words in this field of computers that are metaphors. But they become so ingrained in that computer culture that we don't even think of them that way anymore. For example, we talk about a computer has a virus. Well, a virus is a physical reality that human beings suffer in our own physical bodies. Computers don't catch the same kind of viruses. But nevertheless, that word is used as a metaphor to describe things that can make a computer, another metaphor, sick. Or even kill it. Neither one of which literally happens. But it's relating things we do connect with physically to this specialized field of technology with computers. And so we have viruses. We have Trojan horses appealing to a story that comes out of ancient Greek culture. And then using that about something that happens with a computer. How something stealthily gets onto the computer without you realizing that's what it is, and then after it's in there, then it does its dirty deed. It breaks it or interferes with something else or things like that. Even other parts of the computer are the same way. We talk about computer languages, using something we understand to describe the way programs, there's another metaphor, are written. They're written in code, another metaphor. The computer itself is made up of things like chips. That's a metaphor. It has used to have floppy drives and hard drives. The whole idea of the computer having a drive is a metaphor. And even the word computer itself is a metaphor. I'm not trying to teach you anything particularly about the computer technology and so forth, but we just see how this whole idea of a metaphor just pervades not just the computer industry, but almost any area of study we wanted to look at that involves language. The same is true of the Scriptures. When the Scriptures record Jesus as saying, "I am the good shepherd," that's a metaphor. And he says, "My sheep hear my voice." Sheep is a metaphor, not for those four-legged creatures with wool on them that are out in the open pastures, but for us. We're not literally physically sheep, and he's not literally physically a shepherd. But that metaphor is used of each of us to communicate more clearly a spiritual reality. And so will be the case with the word slave. Now today, as we talk about this metaphor and this spiritual reality of slave, we want to notice that Jesus said in John chapter 8, in the verses that Don read for us at the beginning, that when someone sins, they become a slave of sin, a spiritual reality. A spiritual reality many people do not recognize. In fact, it's a spiritual reality that a significant portion of the thinkers and leaders of our culture, whether it's political or educational or whatever it might be, would deny is true. But it's what Jesus says is true. And that is that when people begin to sin, then they become slaves. Listen to him again in John chapter 8. The context of this is Jesus is having a very public discussion with the religious leaders of the Jews. Some of them were inclined to believe Jesus was the Messiah that the prophets had foretold was coming. And so in verse 31 of John 8, to the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Jesus said, if you're really going to be my followers, you're going to have to hold on to my teaching. It's not enough just to believe generically that Jesus was the Messiah that had been promised by the Old Testament prophets. They needed to go much further than that, and they had to actually hear and adhere to his teachings. And he says, when you do that, you will know the truth. A lot of things that we think we know, and a lot of things the world around us believes it knows, is actually false. Because we only see the world around us, without God's help, from very limited knowledge and vision. And so our reasons for believing why many things are as they are and why things work the way they work and our even belief about how things will turn out are all false because they do not have reality behind them. Jesus says, if you will hold to my teaching, then you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Well, the whole word free was a pretty sensitive subject among the Jews. It still is today among them. They like to think that they've never been slaves to anybody. We're talking about in a physical sense, and not even in the physical sense of the individual slave who is owned by an individual person, but rather that they as a people had ever been enslaved to anyone since the day they came out of Egypt in the days of Moses. And so as a result of that thinking on their part, they answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone," which patently was not true. They believed a falsehood about themselves. They had convinced themselves, had for generations, that they were free. Even as they're speaking to Jesus, they're not free. They were under the oppressive thumb of Rome even then. They could not even choose their own high priest. They could not execute their own criminals. They could not tax their own people without Rome's permission. They were not free. They were run and controlled by Rome. And before Rome, they were controlled by another group of people, and before that another, and before that another. Even as a nation, they had, ever since the days of the Assyrians and then the Babylonians, in the days we're reading about in our Bible class in Jeremiah and before in Isaiah when we were reading it, ever since those days they had been slaves to one other nation after another, right down to Jesus' day. The total amount of time they'd ever been a free nation since, say, 700 B.C., total less than 75 years. All the rest of the time, they'd been enslaved to somebody. And so here they're saying, we've never been enslaved to anybody. Well, they believe a falsehood. But Jesus isn't even concerned about their political freedom. They say, how can you say that we shall be set free? And Jesus replied, I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave of sin. They believed another falsehood, that when the Messiah came, he was going to set them free and make them an independent nation again and then rule over them as their king. That was a falsehood. What the Messiah was going to come to do was to set them free from sin and then be their king as citizens. And so Jesus says, I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave of sin. He wants to change a whole conversation and get them to realize that the freedom he's talking about is very different than the one they were thinking about. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. Certainly, that's just an observation from their everyday culture. Slaves, even though they had rights and privileges, one of the rights they did not have is to guarantee they would always be part of the same household or be owned by the same master. That was not guaranteed to. However, when a son is born into a family, he will always be a part of that family. That was especially true in Jewish culture. And so he says, so if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. He says he's the son of God, but he came to set the sons of God free. He says, I know you're Abraham's descendants, yet you are ready to kill me because you have no room for my word. I'm telling you what I've seen in the Father's presence, and you do what you have heard from your father. And of course, the conversation goes on. We're not, again, planning to study primarily Jesus' teaching here, but just pick up on this idea that when someone begins to sin, they become a slave to sin. And it's this metaphor, the same one that we are looking at more generally about being slaves to Christ. We need to understand how some people are not slaves of Christ. They're slaves of sin. The Apostle Peter says the same thing in his little epistles of 2 Peter. He's talking about some of the false teachers and those who were trying to lead away Christians in his day. And he says in 2 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 17, these men are springs without water. That's almost like something right out of Jeremiah we've been discovering about cisterns without water. These men are springs without water and mist driven by a storm. In other words, they promise something they can't deliver. A spring without water doesn't provide water. Clouds that are only a mist that blow over don't provide rain. These false teachers are that way. Blackest darkness is reserved for them, for they mouth empty, boastful words, and by appealing to the lustful desires of sinful human nature, they entice people who are just escaping from those who live in error. What these false teachers were doing were actually appealing to Christians who have just left a world of sin and have obtained not only forgiveness from it, but freedom from it, as Jesus promised. And these false teachers were attempting to pull them right back into it while promising them actually something very different than that. You know, whenever they advertise alcohol or when they advertise tobacco products, you know, I'm not particularly being judgmental of anyone who might use either one of those, but I'm just telling you, if they advertised what they really give you, they would have far fewer people ever using them in the first place. Come start smoking two packs a day and get lung cancer, get throat cancer, get mouth cancer, get tongue cancer. You know, your chances of getting any of those is greatly increased when you smoke. That's reality. But that's not what they advertise. Join the crowd. Be cool. Whatever else they might use to promote that product. Same thing with alcohol. Your chances of getting cirrhosis of the liver or becoming alcoholic or all sorts of things start with drinking the alcohol. But they don't advertise that. These false teachers were the same way. They don't advertise what they're really going to do for people. They instead, as it says, they appeal to the lustful desires of sinful human nature in a very covert way to try to draw these Christians back into sin. He says in verse 19, they promise them freedom while they themselves are slaves of depravity. For a man is a slave to whatever has mastered him. So Peter's talking about the same thing Jesus is, just in a different context. Then again, we hear the Apostle Paul. The early part of the book of Romans is very much about slavery to sin. He starts it in the first chapter. After he talks about, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ because it is a power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes. To the Jew first, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. So that it is written, the righteous will live by faith. So he starts out by talking about not being ashamed of the gospel. Paul, why are you not ashamed of the gospel? Because it is a power of God for salvation. Well, what do we need to be saved from? What do we need to be delivered from? Sin. God's power to deliver mankind from. So that's how Paul begins it. But then he quickly jumps into this situation that mankind, not just the Romans, although it seems to fit very well what was true of the Romans, but what's true of mankind as a whole. For he says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven, Romans 1:18, against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. So they hide what the reality is while in their sin. Since what may be known about God is plain to them or in them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, both His eternal power and His divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. First thing he says that men have hidden because of their wickedness is the existence and nature of God. If people don't believe there's a supreme being that they have to answer to, they feel a lot more comfortable in their sin. And so one of the things that sin does, and here we're actually personifying, there's another figure of speech, when you almost attribute human-like characteristics to something that isn't human. Sin tries to deceive us that there isn't really a God, and sin, and really the one behind sin, which is a very real being, the devil, wants to convince people that there really isn't a God. In fact, he wants to convince people there's not really a devil either. He would rather they not believe in him, because it makes it easier to draw people deeper into sin and keep them there. If they don't believe there's a God who, number one, they'll have to answer to, and number two, who might have provided a way for them to get out of this situation they're in. He says, for although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. And although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. For those who wouldn't buy into the theory that there's no God at all, then here's an alternate for those. Believe that God looks just like a man or like a bird or an animal or is something made out of stone or wood or metal. That's not anything to be afraid of. If that's all God is, the end result will be the same. People don't feel accountable to such a creature as that. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another, because they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lust. And he goes on and on. He's just describing what happens when people become slaves to sin. Now perhaps we would say, well, before I became a Christian, I didn't go this far. Well, he didn't say everybody would go this far, but this is how far people can go who are enslaved to sin. He will say over in chapter 3, speaking to those who were Jewish, who already had a long history of a law that had come down through Moses and known as the people of God, and they had sacrifices to make when they did sin and all of those things. He says in chapter 3 and verse 9, what shall we conclude then? Are we any better? We, meaning we Jews, because Paul was Jewish. Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. The word under here means under the mastery or under the control of sin. In other words, slaves. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. The wise men of this world would like us to believe, yes, there's a few really evil people in our world. And, you know, they might pick out, you know, the typical villains, maybe Hitler, or in our present generation, Saddam Hussein, or Jeffrey Dahmer, or some other mass murderer or killer, the people who masterminded and then helped carry out the things of 9/11, or even the people, as we've just been praying this morning in Nairobi, Kenya, set up this very clear plan to just kill as many people as they could in that shopping mall in Nairobi. And they'll say, yes, there's a few really evil people in the world, but don't say everybody is a slave to evil. Well, Jesus did, and Peter did, and Paul is saying that when we become sinners, we end up being every one of us, not just some of us, slaves to sin. He will say in Romans chapter 6, starting in verse 11, he's talking to these Christians about how they've been set free from that because of the gospel. He says in Romans 6 and 11, in the same way, count yourselves dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus. Therefore, do not let sin reign or rule in your mortal or physical body, so that you obey its evil desires. Do not offer the parts of your body to sin as instruments of wickedness, but rather offer yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and offer the parts of your body to Him as instruments of righteousness. For sin shall not be your master, because you're not under law, but under grace. What then? Shall we sin because we're not under law, but under grace? By no means. Don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone to obey him as slaves, you are slaves to the one whom you obey, whether you are slaves to sin, which leads to death, or slaves to obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you wholeheartedly obeyed the form of teaching to which you were entrusted, and you have been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness. He's talking about that every person finds themselves in one of two conditions, two situations, a slave of sin or a slave in righteousness. There's no in between. Our world thinks differently about that. But that's how we need to see, not just ourselves, but everyone. It's not a point of view that we particularly relish. It's not a point of view we often even want to really acknowledge. And I don't know what images might come up in our mind. One that always comes to my mind, one of my favorite movies when it first came out, or at least when I first saw it, so forth, was The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. You know, that someone's version of the book of Exodus. And I just remember in the movie where they just show these thousands of people being whipped by the slave masters as they were pulling those huge stones up into place to build whatever great monument the Pharaoh wanted. And it was picturing the Jews as slaves. That's one picture of a slave. We might think of the picture of the slave as in our own history with masses of black people out in large fields of corn or cotton or whatever it may be, working, and they're slaves. But there's still another picture of slavery that we actually are most often encountering in our own culture. And that was the picture of slavery in the Roman Empire, in which if you walk down a street in the city of Rome or Ephesus or Corinth or whatever it may be, you had little way of knowing immediately if the person you met was a slave or not. But almost all slaves looked like everyone. They didn't dress much differently. They didn't act much differently. They didn't have something burned on their forehead or a shackle around their neck or their wrist. They were lawyers and doctors and teachers, merchants. That's how slavery actually worked in the Rome. You could very well be a slave and be a person of great prestige, education, and even respect in the community, but be a slave. So what did it mean to be a slave? There are three things we just briefly comment on in closing this morning about slavery, whether it was physical slavery or now, as we've been looking at this morning, spiritual slavery to sin. First of all, to be a slave meant that you were owned exclusively by someone. No, Jesus said, no man can serve two masters. He's using the imagery of slavery. Slaves were owned by just one master. Didn't a fella and the fella next door co-own a slave? I don't think you ever find any examples of that. Slaves were owned exclusively by someone. And the only way someone else could ever own that slave is if ownership was transferred from one to the other. And so when someone is a slave of sin, they are owned exclusively by sin. And they can only become slaves to someone else, God or Christ or righteousness, if ownership is transferred by some means. Secondly, slavery meant complete submission to the master. You did what the master wanted, not what you... It made no difference what you wanted, really. Now, slaves often were rebellious, insubordinate, negligent, and all sorts of other things. And they paid the price for that. They were punished for that. Because the whole idea of slavery is, not my will but thine. One is a slave of sin. Ultimately, as Paul will say in Romans 7, and we didn't get there this morning, but we will come back to it later. He will say, the things I want to do, I can't do. And the things I didn't want to do, I did. Who will deliver me from this? He's describing slavery to sin. People want to break free of what they just euphemistically call bad habits, when the reality is they're sins. But they can't. They're powerless. They do what the master tells them to do. They're slaves to sin. And it's not just the big obvious things either. It's the tiny little things of being deceitful, of being hateful, of being a gossip, of being a liar, of being lazy. Fall in the category of obedience to God's will. We keep obeying while we're slaves to sin. We keep on doing it. We try to change. We can't. We may modify our behavior a little bit. We may even be able to cut back on some things while other things still go untamed in our life. Because we are in complete submission to our master. We must obey him. And more than that, slavery meant total dependence. A slave had to look to the master for whatever they received. They were not only taken care of and provided for by that master, they were given both what they needed and if the master will, what they wanted. The reason people get into sin and stay in sin is because they're given something in return. It might be satisfaction, it might be pleasure, it might be something else. But even those who don't want to be there, who recognize they're enslaved to it and want to break free of it, can't unless someone else comes along to redeem them from that master and break the chains that binds them to it. Slavery to sin is an ugly picture. But the reality is, we and everybody else either has been there or are a slave to sin. We'll continue our talk next week.